This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Indo-Canadian gang violence has been the subject of newspaper headlines in Vancouver with increasing frequency in recent months. So Headlines Theatre is living up to its name by addressing that subject in its latest forum theatre production, titled Here and Now. Laura Lamb saw the play on Thursday, and she's here with her comments. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Jane.
Now, before we get to the current production, Here and Now, can you fill us in a little bit for people who aren't familiar with it, with Headlines Theatre and their practice of forum theatre? How is it actually different from a regular play?
Yeah, this is the first time I'd ever seen one of their performances, and I heard about them before. And they're very different from a regular play in that in every way, because they begin not with a script written by a playwright, but with some issue. And then they take it through a series of community meetings where they try to narrow down the issue and find the drama in it. They do workshops. People who come to the meetings, from those people, they choose actors. And then those actors work through again until they come up with a play. Then the play, when it's performed, the play is interactive with the audience. So really, from beginning to end, it's quite different from regular dramatic productions.
And what's the thinking behind that approach?
Well, their aims, Headlines Theatre's aims, are very activist. They're educational, I would say, or really wanting to make social change directly, rather than most theatre productions, which, although social change certainly might be part of what a theater production might be aiming for, it'd be the minor part, and the major part is the artistic part. Whereas this production is very pragmatic in its aims. As they say, we want our play to explore real solutions to these problems.
I guess it's also really current.
Oh yeah, yeah. Trying to be right with the headlines.
So, what story did the community members come up with?
Well, the story we saw in the play really centers on the family dynamics of an immigrant family where the parents were born in India, and the children grew up and were born and grew up here, and the communication problems between the generations. And then there's another aspect of it which actually deals with conflicts within a criminal gang. And the drama really centers on the teenage son who is drawn into this dangerous gang situation.
And then what actually happens when the forum part of the forum theater comes into effect during the play?
Yeah, well, what they do, first they run through the play like a normal play from beginning to end, and then they do it again, and under the leadership of the director, audience members can yell out stop when they think something when they would like to change something in the play. And then they go up on stage and take the place of the actor and continue the play that way. So it's very interesting because it allows audience members to follow that impulse, which probably everyone has had at one time or another, perhaps the first play you've ever seen. You know, if you imagine seeing Hamlet and when wanting to yell out, "Don't stab that curtain, you idiot! Don't you know you have to look behind a curtain before you stab someone?" You know. So if you could actually yell that out and then go up and take Hamlet's place and act more sensibly, and as David Diamond says, make safety for the characters.
Is safety what we go to the theater to see? I mean, doesn't this kind of like eliminate the tragedy in Hamlet?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you did that in Hamlet, there wouldn't be, the tragedy wouldn't happen. So, yeah, no more tragedy.
And is that a good thing?
Well, it could be a very revolutionary thing. In a way, it's similar to what Brecht in his theories of the theater in the 1920s was trying to do when he objected to the whole theory of tragedy by saying that it made the audience passive. And he brought in a new theory of theater, which he called epic theater, which he wanted to make the not give the audience the sense of completion, of catharsis, that everything was going to be okay, so that they would go out and become activists. That was part of his theory. So in this sense, this is even more revolutionary in that it challenges the whole, every aspect, every convention of the theater. It's as if someone in the audience was saying something like, well, why do we have to sit here passively while they, on the stage, are in control of everything, and we just sit here. So it, in a way, is a method which could empower the audience.
Did you feel empowered? I mean, what was it? How did you feel yourself being a member of that audience?
Yeah, there was quite a gap between what I thought could happen and how I felt. I actually felt like I was sort of an observer in a drama class, and I got that phrase from my companion, who's a high school student, so she's kind of close to drama classes, and she said, I feel like I'm sitting in a drama class. I felt somewhat manipulated by the whole situation because, for instance, right at the beginning when the forum started, the director, David Diamond, got us all to stand up and move around a little bit, which was good. And then he said, I want everyone in the audience who feels that these issues that came up in the play do not touch you to sit down, please. So I looked around. You know, who's going to sit down? You feel like a schmuck if you sat down. And you know what issues don't touch you? If they could be, it could have been a play about spaying and neutering your pets, and you know, the issues touch you in some way. You know, I mean, so you could feel justified in, well, yeah, I'm going to stand up with everybody else. I'm not going to sit down. And yeah, I felt a little bit uncomfortable with that, and I felt. What I was really observing, rather than a revolution of a theater, was a very different kind of theater in a way, where the director becomes a performer and a teacher. The role of the director, the public role of the director, is really big once the forum starts, because he has to manage everything, and it's pretty hard to imagine how you could intervene as an audience member without a really strong director there, making sure that things were still dramatic, and making sure that the aims of the social aims didn't get diverted somewhere else. So, I almost felt as if there was a sense in that David Diamond didn't like being a behind the scenes director. Directors are really important, but they usually you don't know what they've done unless you're an actor, and all of the actors get all the credit. And so, I felt a little bit like, yeah, okay, this is a performance by a director.
So you didn't enjoy yourself?
Well, no. Now I've got all my negative points out of the way. I actually did enjoy myself, but in a fairly conventional way, in that I was entertained. I was entertained by the audience members who got up and intervened and tried to redirect the action in this fictive world. And they did it, you know, with real thought, a lot of them with a lot of style, you know, so that the play was still a performance that you could enjoy watching. And, you know, some not so much, but all with a lot of sincerity. So I was impressed with those people. You know, I'm not the kind of person who would do that. I also thought that the actors rose to the challenge of being able to perform with audience members, to improvise, which is not easy in itself, and to improvise with people who are not trained as improvisers. It's a very, very complex skill, and some of these actors have never acted professionally before, and perhaps never acted at all before. So that was very interesting to see. And I was also impressed with just the way the production was done, how David Diamond managed the whole event. And yes, you know, all the behind-the-scenes stuff that we couldn't see, it really was very skilled.
Now, as you said at the outset, the theatre has very pragmatic social aims to create social change. Is it successful in its own terms?
Yeah, I think In a modest way, yes, I think it is. And probably, you know, it understands what it's capable of doing. You know, I'm talking about Headlines Theater. The discussions and the issues that came out of the interventions are so many and so huge that, you know, they could have gone on all night doing that stuff. And then the discussions of how to implement some of these ideas that were coming out could go on, you know, will take a lot of work by many members of the community to be able to implement them. And I think Headlines Theatre does everything they can to try to promote that continuation of discussion and community input. So, yeah, I think it is a good way to open up a community discussion.
Did it actually deal directly with the media coverage of Indo-Canadian gangs?
Not within the play, no. But they did have they had some information when you came in and in the introduction about the media coverage and some questioning about whether that coverage is racist. And the point being, if there's a white gang, they're not called a white gang, they're just called a gang, which of course is the same in a culture in which it's normal to be white and to be male. You know, you're a doctor or a female doctor, you're a criminal or you're an Asian criminal, right? That's something that is always going to come up and has to be dealt with. So they sort of bracketed the performance with that question. But the performance itself was really about the specific situation within an immigrant community and how the parents, by trying to protect their children, are perhaps driving them into dangerous situations.
Well, thanks very much for going to see it and coming and telling us about it.
Yeah, thank you.
I've been speaking with Laura Lamb about the Headlines Theatre production Here and Now. It's running until December 11th, both in Vancouver and in Surrey, and then there's going to be a live telecast of Here and Now on Shaw TV Cable 4 on December 11th at 8 p.m.
Wondering what chemicals are found in the blood of Canadians? Check Toxic Nation. Toxic Nation is a report on the first test for a broad range of toxic chemicals in average Canadians from across the country. The report was released last week by Environmental Defence Canada. Sarah Winterton is a program director with Environmental Defence. She was also a participant in the study, and she joins me now by phone. Hi, and good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Mordecai.
Maybe you could begin by outlining the main findings of the Toxic Nation report.
Well, we tested for 88 different chemicals, and we found the presence of 60 of them in the blood of 11 Canadians. So on average, actually, each person had 44 chemicals.
44. What kind of chemicals are we talking about?
We're talking about heavy metals, PCBs, flame retardants, the chemical that's used as a stain repellent or on nonstick cookware. We're talking about chemicals that are carcinogens, hormone disruptors, respiratory toxins, and developmental toxins.
Are these chemicals associated with any particular diseases?
Well, these chemicals are, as I outlined before, they do have toxic effects. And certainly these effects have been documented when you have high levels. When you're exposed to high levels. The levels that we found in the volunteers were, for the most part, low. So we don't have good information about what happens to your health when you're exposed day after day after day, perhaps a lifetime of exposure to low levels of toxic chemicals. And we certainly don't have good information about how all of these chemicals work together in your body. So we don't know what the cumulative impact is on a person's health.
And would these chemicals be expected not to be present in a completely unpolluted environment?
Certainly the PCBs, the flame retardants, the stain repellent chemicals, those are all manufactured. So they shouldn't be in our bodies at all. Things like lead, mercury, arsenic, they can show up in the environment. So so there are background, naturally occurring background levels, but you still don't want those in your body. And we certainly don't want more of them being put into the environment through industrial emissions.
You did some tests on a group of people across the country. Are some, the results show that people in some either age group, gender, or region are more susceptible to, have been subjected, I guess, more to toxic chemicals than other gender, age, or region?
Well, the overwhelming finding, I think, was it didn't really matter where you live, how old you are, or what you do for a living, the toxic chemicals showed up in you. So our age ranges were from mid-20s to mid-70s, from people from coast to coast. Certainly the older volunteers had more chemicals. The people who were sort of, who were over 60 had 51. I'm in my mid-40s, I had 43. And the younger volunteers in their mid-20s, they had lower amounts. But the interesting thing was they had the least number of PCBs. So PCBs were banned in the 70s. They were banned before these two women were born. So it's a bit of good news. Maybe banning them has worked. You know, they're not showing, not as many are showing up in these younger women. But at the same time, this is 25 years later, and they're persisting. They're still showing up in people, even though they've been banned for close to 30 years. So it's sort of a mixed good news, cautionary story there. We also had one volunteer, Chief David Massey, who lives very, very far from any point sources of pollution, and he was actually the most contaminated person. He had the highest level of mercury. He had the highest level of stain repellent, that the chemical that's used in for stain repellent pants, or the chemical, same chemical that's used in nonstick cookware. He had the highest level of the flame retardants as well. So even though he lives far away from everything, he was the worst, had the highest numbers.
When you say far away from everything, what where does he live?
Well, he's halfway up James Bay, so there isn't any major industry around him. So there's a, It's fairly well documented that a lot of these pollutants, they sort of flow or blow north. There tends to be an accumulation based on wind patterns, water flow, all of those different kinds of things. And so they're finding that some of these chemicals are accumulating in the north.
Can you protect yourself by certain lifestyle choices?
All of these chemicals showed up in people, regardless of as I said, where they live or what they do for a living. Many of the volunteers have a fairly high percentage of organic in their diet. There were only, I believe, two smokers in the group. That is a message that the chemicals are out there everywhere, and we are exposed to them through the air we breathe, the food that we eat, water that we drink, products that we use. However, on a day-to-day level, you can make choices as to the kinds of products that you're using, and try to diminish or decrease the kinds of chemicals you may be exposed to. So it's a big problem that needs a long-term solution. We need federal legislation to eliminate the toxic chemicals from getting into the environment in the first place. But immediately, you want to know what you can do, right? So, okay, try to make choices that will get rid of unnecessary exposures in your daily life. And what we have on our website, which is toxicnation.ca, we have a list of choices that you can consider making that will help to reduce your exposure.
This testing that you did is very expensive, and your resources were limited. So, in effect, it was a small number of people that you were able to test. If somebody came by and said, well, that's too small a number to have any indication, what would your response be?
Well, I would say it's true. It was only 11 people, but these were people who were in disparate areas of the country, drastically different ages, different occupations, and none of them actually is getting an occupational exposure. So it's a sort of regular life, what you're encountering in your regular day-to-day activities. So even though it's 11 people, it's hard to imagine what would bind us all that would give us this kind of an average exposure of 44 chemicals per person. So I think that it's indicative of these chemicals, since they're in the environment, since they're ubiquitous, since they persist, they're impossible to avoid. It would be, I can't imagine how anybody could avoid them. We only tested for 11 people because it is expensive. So we had to test for 88 chemicals. It was $1,500 per person. There are other studies that have been done in the States where they tested 9 people for 210 chemicals. Similar studies have been done with smaller groups of people for this kind of measure, just to find out what toxins are showing up.
So it's like, for you, a point of view that this is the canary. You don't need to have people falling over dead. The small sample is still in and of itself indicative of a major problem.
I think the small sample is indicative that every Canadian is carrying a chemical burden. As I said, we tested for 88. We could have tested for hundreds more, but we couldn't afford it. I think testing for more will find out that there are more in us. Other studies have proven that these chemicals are actually found in umbilical cord blood. So the fetus is getting a load of toxic chemicals as it's growing. So from, you know, point of conception onward, we're being exposed to toxic chemicals.
What, in your view, should the government be doing to better protect us against exposure to these toxic chemicals?
We're calling on the Canadian government to be a leader on this issue. Right now, the Canadian Environmental Protection Act is undergoing its mandated 5-year review. So we're looking at, first and foremost, they should be getting rid of the most toxic chemicals. Let's stop putting more carcinogens, more hormone disruptors, more respiratory toxins out into the environment. For the most part, these chemicals persist. They stay out there for decades. Some of them actually probably never go away. We don't need to keep adding more. This would involve industry being much more accountable for the chemicals that it's using. So the onus would be on industry to prove that a chemical is safe before it gets into the market. Industry should also be looking at substituting the most toxic chemicals with safer alternatives. We have to turn this around. It's rampant. And as you said, we're the canaries. And the warnings are there, and they've been proven in tests on other populations, like in the U.S. and in the U.K. Industrial society is contaminating its population.
I know you were one of the people who was tested, and for someone listening, like myself, not knowing what is my personal level of contaminant, I can sort of look at it and say, I guess it's a danger. I'm convinced of that, but I won't have the emotional core in it that you have. I'm wondering how you responded when you found the actual results of the level of contamination and the range of contamination that is within you.
Well, I was shocked. I expected to find something because, as part of the process of this study, but I was personally quite shocked to see the range. I had, as I said, 43 out of the 88. And so that meant I've got mercury, lead, arsenic, I've got flame retardants, I've got the stain repellent, I've got PCBs, I've got pesticides, I've got insecticides. And so, digesting that and then thinking, well, these are carcinogens, these are toxins that are in me, and then thinking that we only tested for 88. So I have to just extrapolate that and think there are hundreds more in me. And there are hundreds more in everybody. So it's you burst the bubble of denial pretty quickly when you're looking at your name beside this list of chemicals And then you're looking at the potential effect of carcinogen, hormone disruptor. It's pretty sobering.
Thank you very much for speaking with us this morning.
You're very welcome, Mordecai.
Bye-bye, Sarah.
Bye-bye.
I've been speaking with Sarah Winterton. She's the program director with Environmental Defense Canada. And if you'd like to check out their report, Toxic Nation, it's called, just go to www.toxicnation.ca.